Welcome. Another series, another episode in the Cunning Chats. And I have historically always done legends of the scene, people that were part of the foundation of what built the sort of rave, hardcore, jungle, drum and bass scene. And I'm going to start introducing some different people into this. As you all know, there's been a phenomenal wave of a resurgence of people, producers, DJs being inspired by that sound from the 90s, you know, making it their own, taking their own twist on it and pushing and continuing that forward. So my next guest that's on today has been pivotal in that, not just in the last couple of years that we've seen the popularity and the growth of this scene, but been in this for many years beforehand, setting the original initial foundations for it. Owns one of the most influential labels that are out there that are doing releases and collaborations with other artists and other labels as well, that is really not just set the foundation of what's going on, but is leading the charge about where this is going. So it's great pleasure for me to introduce man that is just on it. It's the Tim Reaper. How you doing, mate? You all right?
I'm good, mate. How about you?
I'm doing very well, mate. Very well indeed, mate. Thank you very much. I know you're a super busy guy, so I appreciate your time today. Yeah, so listen, I would love to just kind of get started, as I do with most of the guests, really. You know, what was your moment of musical connection when you first heard something, whether it was a place or a song or something where you actually connected with music?
Yeah, so I got into drum and bass first and foremost, and knew drum and bass around 2007, 2008, because when I was in school doing my GCSEs, I had this media studies course that I got to do, where I had to get two music magazines and analyze the differences between them. And one of the magazines was a Mix Mag, and it had an Andy C mix CD on the cover, because they usually do the free mix CDs of every issue. And out of curiosity, I just put the CD in and listened to it. And the energy of the music was just like unbelievable. It was like nothing I'd ever heard before. So I was just like, whatever this is, I need to find more of it, because it's just like, it just completely took me in. And for about a year or so, I was mostly just listening to like the new drum bass stuff, like the stuff that Ram and Shogun and Players and those kinds of labels were releasing, because that was all I really knew. And I used to source some of my music from MySpace, which was really popular at the time, if you remember that, Jay.
I do indeed, mate. That's taking it back some. That was my first social media presence, as it was, I think, with many guys, yeah.
Yeah, and I used to rip music from MySpace, and someone had set up like a profile of DJ Hype that wasn't actually him, but like it just had music on it, and it had Dread Bass by Dead Dread and Super Sharpshooter by the Ganja Crew on it. And for some reason, I found myself listening to those two tracks in particular more so than any of the new drum and bass I'd heard at the time or knew of. And I started getting into forums. I joined Drum Bass Arena forums because I knew of them from the mix CDs that like DJ Hype had done, Andy C and Groove Rider done, Fabian Friction and so on and so forth. And through help from some of the forum members and some of the mixes being posted on there, I sort of worked out that like there was this predecessor drum and bass called Jungle that sort of existed in these few years in the 90s, where it was a bit more focused on breaks and sampling more so than the drum and bass I'd been hearing at the time. And after I found out about that, I started digging through like Discogs and Rob, like, would set up channels on YouTube, just uploading loads of jungle to be like coming home from school every day and basically just trying to school myself, trying to take in as much of this as possible. And I was doing that, and then eventually I just had this like desire to like sort of want to get involved in a way. I wasn't really aware at the time that there were still people making new instances of this old school jungle stuff. So I really wanted to learn how to make it, so I started learning to produce. I downloaded the cracked version of FL Studio because I found a free web tutorial on how to chop the Amen break, how to load it into the project and then sequence it. And then I was just doing that for a while, getting by on that, and I learned how to load samples in and how to like manipulate them, how to create melodies, and eventually I just sort of like started making tunes, really. I think that was about 2-3 years into being just like a fan. I sort of wanted to sort of like really learn how to make.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So before you kind of discovered drum and bass, what kind of things were you listening to?
I was like, because a lot of my music sources was like music television. So I used to listen to channels like MTV Bass, The Box, Kiss TV, Channel U as well for like the grime and the UK rap stuff. So a lot of it was just like, I guess like popular urban music in the way. That was the kind of stuff I was really into because like I didn't really have any sort of link to finding more underground music. Any electronic music I would have known would have been stuff that would have made it in the charts. So like either whatever your big house tune or trance tune or whatever it is. I think maybe I may have known about Pendulum before I knew about drum and bass, but I can't really say for sure that I was that clued up on any sort of drum and bass before that mix CD I'd heard.
Yeah. So you obviously got, you heard it and that's it. It sounds like you went in because it's interesting, right? You know, with people that have normally discovered a genre, the most common path is to then ingrain into that and then follow its path as it's going. But you went against the grain, right? You went, right, what's the history? What's the foundation here?
Yeah.
So this must have been quite a journey for you because obviously, you know, it's a very interesting evolution from, you know, disco to house to hardcore to jungle to drum and bass. You know, how far back were you going once you discovered it into that kind of jungle arena? And, you know, were there specific, were you starting to find that there were certain DJs and producers and labels that you were really gravitating toward?
Yeah, so at first I was really into like the 94, 95 sound, the proper, like, I guess people would know it as jungle. So when it sort of evolved from the hardcore stuff, I was really into like suburban bass, the stuff that was coming out in there, like Chrome and Time and Remark and DJ Dexterous and D-Cruise and that kind of stuff. I was also into the Moving Shadow stuff as well, like Omni Trio and also like Dead Dread. And every now and then I would like be like going through that label, trying to find, all right, so this artist, who is it? What other labels were they released on? Like, you find out about Chrome and Time, you find out about Terran Vinyl, you find out about Remark, you find out about Dollar Records and White House, and you sort of branch out from there. So I guess you could say I was probably more into like the dance floor stuff, the ragga jungle stuff in a way. And then I was on that for a long time, And then I think after that, I was starting to get interested in like the atmospheric stuff. So like the stuff that's come out on Good Looking Records, the stuff that's coming out on like Fresh 86, stuff that like Photek and Digital and all these like producers were making like sort of like deep and more melodic stuff. I found that to be like a different kind of music to what I was like previously knowing of, because a lot of the music I'd listened to was very much like focused on like the dance floor and about like rinse out stuff. And then these guys would come with like a more sort of laid back musicality, and but sometimes they would still maintain that dance floor sensibility. So I sort of got into that and I was on that for a long time as well. And eventually I think I sort of came around to like the more ravier predecessor 92, 93 stuff. I think at first, because some of it was a bit slower or like some of it wasn't like so mental on the drum patterns, that I guess the other stuff took my attention more first. But then eventually, as I had sort of, not exactly burnt myself out in it, but as I'd taken in so much of this stuff, I was like, all right, what other kind of styles could I sort of discover? So I guess that's sort of the lineage for how I was discovering this kind of music.
Yeah. It's, you know, I'm, you know, I was one of the very fortunate few that was able to kind of live through that.
That's nice.
And listen to Pirates and going to the clubs and, you know, I didn't buy a lot of records because, you know, I was just kind of really a kid and wasn't earning that much money. But the discovery of that, you know, I'm still discovering music from that era now. You know, it's amazing how much stuff was so ingrained on so many different layers of it. So I wanted to ask you, you know, as you're kind of discovering this music, are you starting to buy records from that era at that point? How are you kind of building your collection?
Yeah, so I remember when I was in uni, I saw on Drum Bass Arena forum someone's posting up like a job lot of records. I think it was like 25 records for like 150 quid or something like that. And just spur of the moment, I literally just like bought it. I didn't have any decks or any sort of means to play them, but I was like wanting to start DJing. So I sort of wanted to build up a music collection. And I found that at start, I wasn't having much luck with vinyl because I didn't really have much money to get the setup. I was moving around a lot because I was in uni. So like first year I was in halls, and then I moved out in second year, and I moved out third year, and I sort of was like, I didn't really want to have too much possessions to sort of have to carry around with me. And also, yeah, the expense, like vinyl, even like talking maybe like 2013, 2014, like jungle vinyl is expensive now, but back in the day, I mean, back in that time, it was still pretty pricey for me anyway. The idea of paying like £20-25 for a record with two songs, and it sort of felt like I don't think I could justify that. But I somehow managed to discover there were a lot of CD compilations and albums that also came out at the same time in the 90s, and I could buy the CD for like, I don't know, £6, and I could rip it and I'd probably get like 15 or 20 digital files rather than two songs. And I had the equipment to rip it because there's just a CD slot on my computer, and I was able to get a Traktor controller because they were cheaper than getting decks. It was easier to carry around, and it sort of, I started off with digital really because it sort of was more practical for me, and it also allowed me to sort of play the music I was making and the music some of my friends are making that was sending it to me, because like there wasn't that much new jungle coming out on vinyl at the time. A lot of stuff sort of just like sitting there for no one to really take any interest in. So yeah, I sort of started off with digital, and then it wasn't actually until about maybe 2 or 3 years ago that I really started buying vinyl properly, because I just always had this idea of vinyl being quite cumbersome, quite expensive, and never really feeling like I'd be comfortable enough to be able to afford or maintain or even just to own all the music I wanted to own on vinyl and have a proper setup and stuff like that.
It's a real investment, like financially and space-wise. It's funny, as you were saying that story about, you know, moving and not wanting to have those possessions. I spent 93 in New Zealand and came back in 94 and had like a tiny collection, like that big. So so 93 is still a big year for me to dig into because I missed out being involved in it directly. But I moved every year because I was just renting a room in a house over here, there and wherever. And obviously each time I moved, my collection started getting bigger and bigger. And funny enough, as my collection got bigger, the list of friends wanting to help me move got smaller and smaller.
Oh yeah, of course. That's how it goes.
So, you know, it is a big investment. And, you know, I remember moving kind of to that digital. And funny enough, my first introduction to digital was Traktor as well. And I had the S4 controller because it was at the time you could fit it inside a carry-on case on the airplane. And the other ones were a bit too big. And I'm like, you know what? I want everything with me. And the digital, you know, allowed me to really broaden a lot of the music that I was playing.
Yeah, definitely.
And getting as well at the time, you know, people were starting to release less on vinyl. So with the DJing side of things, like, you know, how did you, when was this and how did you kind of learn, you know, to DJ?
So probably I'd say this was about 2013, 2014 where I started learning to DJ. I mean, like previously before that, I would have had maybe like a try here and there with like virtual DJ software stuff like that, just to like not even really know how to beat match, but just to sort of understand the basics of like EQing and like how to bring a tune in, how to take a tune out, how to cue in a tune. But like since a lot of that stuff is sort of very much heavily revolving around sync, I didn't have any idea how to beat match. So when I got this Traktor controller, it was just basically like hours and hours of practice every day just to be able to sort of listen to two tunes and hear that one is slowing down, so speed it up, that one's speeding up, so slow it down, be able to sort of get the right mix of like nudging the tune along on the jog wheel and then knowing to also adjust the pitch on the sliders as well. And it took a long while to actually get properly comfortable with DJing, especially because like I was pretty much self-taught. I didn't really have mates that I lived locally with me, that lived locally with me, that were also into this music and also into DJing. So like I was sort of basically just like left to my own devices, sort of like work out how to build these skills. But eventually it also helped because I was starting to get some sort of profile as a producer. So people would ask me to do like guest mixes for their platforms or for their radio shows. And for a while, actually, I was sequencing the mixes entirely in FL Studio because I didn't feel confident enough to mix it on Traktor. But then eventually I started getting to a point where I could actually do the mix. And then I did a guest mix for Pete Devnall, who runs a radio show on Jungle Train called Blog to the Old School. And eventually I got offered a show on Jungle Train as well, but like I didn't know for sure what time and day I could commit to always being there every 2 weeks. So I asked Pete if he'd be willing to share his slot with me. We do Sunday 10 till 10 p.m. till 12 midnight. And what we started off doing was I would do the whole 2 hours 1 week. And because it's every 2 weeks, he would do the next show 2 weeks from then. So basically, you'd only have to commit to like once a month, really. And I think that was really good for helping me to sort of like build up my skills, to sort of give me like sort of an outlet for showcasing sometimes my music or other people's music. And also just to sort of like keep my skills fresh and build up like more and more knowledge of jungle. So even just like to apply it in a way, because it's like it's well and good to know loads of tunes, but you just sort of like just keep that to yourself. It's not as effective, I think, as like being able to DJ it and showcase the music.
Who was inspiring you as a DJ? Who were you looking at and going, yeah, they're on it?
I would say, well, a lot of the tapes I was listening, well, when I started listening to like mixes as well, because firstly I was just like discovering music through just YouTube channels and whatever I could find online, and I started listening to mixes and some of the old rave tapes. I would be like a big fan of Booker mixes, Randall, Dr. S. Gache, Mickey Finn, Hype. And in terms of like newer DJs that were still doing stuff, I would say probably Equinox. I used to tune into his Scientific X radio show on Jungle Train. Mantra and Double O from Rupture, they also had a show on Jungle Train that I tuned into. Code from Subtle Audio, he still does his show on Jungle Train. A lot of it's basically focused around Jungle Train. Also, Chris in Perspective, he used to do a show on Jungle Train on Mondays. I used to tune in for that. So a lot of my new like sources of like DJing was sort of revolving around other people on the station at the time, I'd say.
So let's focus a little bit more on the production side. Obviously, that is, you know, a huge part of who you are and what you do now. You know, you talked about FL Studio being that first introduction and kind of getting into chopping up Amons. Talk us about kind of building up to that point where, you know, you got your first release done and out there.
So I used to just have my SoundCloud page. I would just like whatever tune I'd make, I'll just bang it up on there. And it was also around the time when AOL Instant Messenger was like the main way to communicate with other people in music, if you remember that. AOL Instant Messenger?
Yeah, I mean, Andy C was like, we would check, I'm sure his AOL was like getting like 150 tunes a day on that one, but that was definitely the way to get music around for sure.
Yeah, so I used to chat to people on AIM and I would send out tunes to people. And back in the day, I was maybe not sure if it was like youthful arrogance or just like lack of fear of judgment, but I would send my music to absolutely anyone, like Jump Up, Neuro, Liquid, whatever your style of music was, I'd probably be sending you Jungle just in case you happen to like it. And I sent some tunes of mine to DJ Trace. At the time, it was very heavily into like his more techie roller drum bass kind of style, but since I knew him from the jungle days, I took a chance and sent him some tunes. And 6 months later, he got back to me like, I actually really like these tunes, mate. Are they still available to put out? And I was like, I put them on SoundCloud already. Sorry about that, mate. But he's like, well, if you want, I've got the samples for Final Chapter, which is a tune he released on DJ Recordings. And he asked if I'd be up for doing a remix of it. And I was like really excited for it. So I did a remix for him. He liked it. And then he released it on his label Decipher on the flip side of a remix that Ed Rush and Optical did of Sonar that never came out. So it was quite a fairly high profile release. And when he put it out, people seemed to really like it. And I think that sort of set me up to sort of just continue on with that. I had a few more releases of him on when he set up his 117 label, when he did his Amon Wolf compilation on Cypher. And eventually, I just kept working on tunes, sending out tunes to people. Sometimes people would show interest and wanted to play out with them. Sometimes they'd want to release them. And also just working with producers on collaborations and remixes sort of helped sort of like just grow in a way.
Are these tunes around the sort of 174 drum and bass tempo, or were you doing stuff around the sort of 160 mark then?
It was a bit of both really, because like I liked fast stuff, but I also found sometimes that the tunes I'd work in at the time, they would sometimes just sound a bit better when they were slowed down a bit. So I would usually try and work around 160, 165, but sometimes I would just go as fast as I wanted to really.
And obviously right now predominantly the stuff you're making is around that 160. So
yeah,
at what point did you kind of make that decision? Think, right, you know what, this is the kind of tempo threshold that I'm comfortable at and that I want to work at.
I think it was when I was doing these sets, I would be mixing them with old jungle tunes. A lot of them are like around the 155, 160. Some do go a lot faster than that, but the majority of them, you're sort of around that tempo. And even though with digital, you can pitch stuff up as fast or as slow as you like, I guess after a certain percentage range, it sort of gets a bit outside of a certain percentage range, sort of sounds a bit strange. So I sort of thought, like, for practicality wise, to actually play these tunes alongside the 90s stuff, it would sort of make sense if the tunes weren't like ridiculously quick.
And what with the production style, so you know, mm-hmm. It sounds like you kind of started off kind of teaching yourself, finding whatever resources you can.
Yeah.
You know, did you start working with anyone, or how did you see your kind of production levels? Because you know, I look at when I get music from you,
mm-hmm.
I'm honest, I never know what to expect, and I love yeah. that, right? Because yeah. it could be a bit more of a jungle techno 4/4 type influence thing. It could be sort of a hardcore jungle crossover. It could yeah. be a straight up Amen smasher. I know that's kind of sort of two questions there. So, but you know, this the style, you know, what's your kind of approach and thinking behind when you're making a track?
So usually when I start making a tune, it's usually when I've heard a good sample somewhere, or like I'm just playing around with synths and I find like a good patch or something like that. And it's sort of like, I feel like in the way a friend of mine told me, just like how he does it, so similar to mine, is like you just go with the sounds in the way. So it's sort of like you just start making the tune. And I think the context around that tune in terms of what style you go to sort of just like makes its own decision in a way. So I find that usually sort of leads to style. But also I think sometimes it can also be down to like, if I felt like the style of music that I like, I haven't made an example of it in a while, I'll sort of feel like an urge to sort of get back on that tip. So like if I haven't made like a calm, atmospheric sort of like good looking record style tune in a while, I'll sort of have that like want to sort of get on that tip. Or like if I've made like a hardcore jungle techno stomper for a while, I'll sort of be like, I haven't done that in a while, let me give it a crack, let me have a crack at it and sort of see where it goes. So sort of like from my own like interest, I guess, in a way, sort of keep me like excited. I sort of like try and switch up the styles whenever I can really.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think you and a lot of producers are really good at, you know, we've mm-hmm. seen before that, you know, there's a lot of admiration and nostalgia and love for that 90s era and that music and what it did. Mm-hmm. And there's been some areas where people have tried to reignite that, right? And they've not done it necessarily the right way, because what they've tried to do is just kind of copy what that era has done.
Yeah.
You know, but what you and the label clearly do, and what I think is hugely important, is that, you know, rather than kind of replicating it, it's actually be about being inspired by it.
Yeah.
You know, adding your own flavor to it and then pushing it forward, because, you know, the 90s are the 90s, right?
Yeah.
But now is now. And, you know, I often say this, I look at that era moving at such breakneck speed, you know, with all those different individual styles from sort of 91, 92 up to sort of 94, 95, 96. You know, they all, some of these styles had such short shelf lives, you know. You look at that kind of sort of Tango Ratty Fallout Dark Side kind of vibe, you know, really that was probably only what, not even a year that stuff was being released before it evolved and moved on. So, you know, kudos to you, and I think you've really, I feel that you've kind of led the charge in this, in the, you know, there's something very familiar about what you produce and you release, but there's also something very fresh and forward thinking about it at the same time. And I think that's a really important balance, right, in regard to this scene and how it evolves and moves forward.
Yeah, absolutely, because I find with my approach, it's like there is a somewhat, not exactly formula, but maybe I guess you could say like a template of like how you could probably make a jungle tune. And then it's on you to basically inject whatever sounds you want to do into that. So like I try to not sample stuff that's exactly been like hammered in previous jungle tunes. I sort of feel like nowadays we can sample anything we want. So it's not really that necessary to sort of sample jungle to make more jungle. Or if you do do that, try and do as much as you can, sort of twist it up, make it not as recognizable or as bait as it might seem when it's just like a loop from a jungle tune and you make a jungle tune around that. And I also find that since there's so much music that wasn't used in jungle tunes and at the time, and there wasn't, and there's been so much music made since then in other styles of music that you could bring into a jungle context, I feel like it's necessary to sort of like add more stuff to what I call like the gene pool of sounds in this genre, because I do like the way that people were making jungle in the 90s, just that now I have more possibilities for, I guess, what you can sample, because you're not so limited in scope in a way.
Well, you know, I think you're one of very few artists that, you know, do have such a broad range and maintain it and do that really well. You know, there's a lot of, you know, I'm looking at the kind of scene in general and looking at something like Parallax, for example. You know, Valley's label is very focused on that kind of hardcore jungle kind of crossover. You look at Deep Jungle, which is very focused on that 94, 95 sound. You know, and you look at something like, you know, Radio Rave Records, which is focused on the more hardcore side of it. You know, it's really exciting when I look inwards into this scene, seeing all these different pockets of producers and labels that are taking their inspiration and from that era and going, right, we're going to take that slice of the pie, we're going to then kind of move it forwards. So look, I want to talk about the label Future Retro London. You know, it's such an important part of this scene, right? You know, it is produced and provided some phenomenal music. I love the fact that, you know, you use it as a platform for yourself, but actually I, from an outsider person looking in, you use this more as a platform for collaboration, you know. The Meeting of the Mind series I think is amazing. You know, it's a really important unifying part of this scene, right? You know, collaboration is key. Scenes don't move forward, you know, there are individual silos around, but actually we'll move further and better together, right? Before we get into the Meeting of the Minds, let's talk about the label. Tell me about kind of, you know, how it came about and how it got started.
So Future Retro London, basically, so first it actually started as like an event space. So one day I was playing this event in London. It was a free event and the lineup was really good. But like when I got there, there's probably like maybe like 30 people there or something like that at most. And I was playing last. And by the time I started playing, I think there was like 5 people left. By the time I finished playing, I think there was like 2 people left or something like that. And when I got home the next day, I was like a bit disheartened about like things and the way they are. And I was having like a daydream where it was me in the future, like 10, 15 years from now, and I'm being interviewed by like a journalist who's like asking me questions about like how I was involved in the new jungle scene at the time and who all these people were and like, or how it felt to be part of it and stuff like that. And the journalist asked me a question like, so then at X point, this scene sort of fizzled out and sort of just ended up becoming nothing. And what would you say your reasons were for that? Or what do you think were the reasons for that scene fizzling out? And I gave a few reasons in the interview, but one that stuck with me was I said that for the new jungle scene, there wasn't really like a place where if you were outside of the scene, you could say this is the place where it's all happening, where everything is, where everyone is. Like Rupture was like, they would have the new jungle alongside the new drum bass, alongside the old school. So like you would have maybe like me and Ward maybe doing a set there in the old school room. Or you might have like a lineup they do. Maybe they have like Sully playing at one time and then Coke playing another time. But I sort of felt like there was room for an event where it's like me and Ward and Coco and Sully all just playing New Jungle the whole night through. And I saw in the dream, I was like, if I had a time machine, I would travel back in time and I would start an event based around the New Jungle scene. And it may not have saved the scene, but it would have at least given it more lifespan or given it a better chance at like actually building something for itself. So I came out of that dream and I was like, I think I actually have to make this happen, you know. And the funny thing is, I never want to be a promoter. I never wanted to be a promoter. I always felt like promoting is probably the worst job in music because, like, there's so much risk for not that much reward. There's so many things that can go wrong that are completely out of control. There's, like, so much stress on you. There's so many people that are on to you, like the club owners, the punters, the artists, the MCs. There's so many, it's like spinning plates like non-stop, and then what you get out of that seems to be, for me anyway, I didn't think it was worth the hassle. But like I came out of that dream like, I just need to put this idea into action. And I was asking around the people just to make sure that I wasn't like completely insane or like I wasn't stepping on anyone's toes with this idea, and everyone seemed to think it was an idea worth going for. And it was actually Equinox who gave me the name of the event, Future Retro. So I have to thank him for that. And I still live in South London, but at the time I was living in Rotherhithe. And selfishly, I wanted to do the night in South London as well, just I guess for ease of like getting to the venue, or if I needed to come back home and fix something and go back to the venue, it'd be easier for me if I was in South London. So I was looking around for venues, and the one I wanted to do was in Peckham. It was called Rywax, and it was also quite small capacity. I think it's like 200 people maximum or something like that. So I thought it'd be like an easy way to sort of like test the waters in this idea. So I got in touch with them, and they basically ignored me for months. And when they finally did get back to me, they were like, we're completely booked up for weekends until like the summer. And this was around the start of 2020 or 2021, I think, that I started actually planning the event. So I was like, oh, I really want to make this happen now. And at the time, there was like this newish venue that had opened down the road, actually, called Peckham Audio. And Club Glow were doing their nights there. So I went down to one just to see what it was like. And I was sold on it. So I sort of met the club manager. His name is Tom. And we basically started chatting on email about making this event happen. And I got the date for it. I'm like, all right, cool. Now I just need to think of a lineup. So the original lineup was me, Dward, Coco, Bryce, Tully, and Dead Man's Chest. And I asked around with them, see if they'd be up for playing this night and they're playing this day. And everyone was happy and all up for it. I designed the art for myself. I designed the flyer, I designed the logo, and then I put it up there online, and the ticket seemed to do all right, actually. So I was like, all right, cool. It's looking like it's going to go well. And then the pandemic happened, and I was like, all right, cool. I think I'd done that. At the time, it was just starting the pandemic. I had no idea how long it was going to go on for. So I was like, all right, let's move this to, I don't know, June or July 2020, or 2021, I think, just to sort of give it time for it to pass and it'll happen. And then it didn't pass until like the year after, was where I finally did the first event. But during that time where I put the event idea on hiatus, I had this idea for like a release themed around collaborations, because even before that I'd worked with a lot of producers just because I like collaborating with people and like the shared synergy that you can have, like when two people come together and sort of like just pitch ideas back and forth and like the meeting of styles in a way. And I had this idea for a collaboration series, and I was trying to think of like what labels I work with currently that would facilitate this idea. It'd give me complete creative control over who's on it, who I collaborate with, that is, and what the tunes are and how the artwork is and all this kind of business. And I couldn't really think of any labels at the time that would probably facilitate this idea. So I sort of felt like Future Retro, I'd sort of built up a bit of an audience promoting the first night. So I was going to try. I had an idea for a label. I didn't really want to start the label until long after the event was established. But then I was just like, I'll just do the label in the meantime, keep the brand sort of afloat in a way. And then I started hitting up, I made a long list of producers I wanted to work with. I started hitting them all up because like some producers can take quite a while to get back to you, or quite a while to like get anything done. So I wanted to, based off of how I know Deep Jungle and Greenbow X were releasing music, it sort of made sense to drop two at the same time because I was going to self-distribute it. So I needed 8 collabs from 8 different people. So I messaged, I think, like 14 people, expecting, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 of them to actually get back in touch. And all 14 got back to them straight away saying they're up for it. I'm like, okay, crap. Something's going on here. So literally, I think I finished, like, 10 collabs in 10 days or something like that. Some ridiculous amount. Like, literally, wow. Like, I was like, because usually the format of the collaboration is I try and get the other person to start the tune and I'll finish it. Sometimes it can go the other way, but the majority of them is, like, tunes that they've started and sent it over, and I'll just work on it whenever I can. And I built up about 10 people sent me tunes to work on. I basically just plowed through it like every day after work just to get the ideas done. And then I knew how manufacturing worked with vinyl because I've been sort of like loosely involved with Greenbow X, and I'd sort of picked up some tips from like knowing Equinox and Harmony and Simon, who used to run similar story projects. I sort of like would chat to them about stuff and sort of like get help from them and sort of like just see how they run things and sort of like have this idea of like, all right, so you speak to this person, vinyl broker, who will put you in touch with pressing plant and sort of like handle the mastering, get the lacquers done, get the test presses back, approve them, and then just wait for the final copies to come back and stuff like that. So I was pretty comfortable with like the releasing process. And Meet in the Minds Volume 1 or 2, I think that one came out. Actually, when did that come out?
2020.
Actually, let me quickly. But I put them up for pre-order before I had the copies. But the response was actually much better than I thought it would be, because I sort of felt like it'd be a really slow start in terms of like actually getting people interested in what I was doing. But I guess the concept behind it and the presentation was enough to sort of get people's attention from the start, because I didn't really know anyone at the time that had done a collaborations themed series in Jungle. So I guess that idea, I guess maybe it attracted people, and I kept doing that. I did Meet in the Minds Volume 1 through 8, and then a friend of mine, actually Basic Rhythm, he sent me a tune called Turning Me On, and I really liked the tune, but like at the time I hadn't really had this vision of doing anything on the label besides Meet in the Minds, because I just felt like then it would just become a regular label that doesn't have like concepts behind the release. And he was just like, just try out a main label regular release and see how it goes. So then I spoke to Ricky Force, who I'm a big fan of his work, and I did a collab with him on Meet in the Minds Volume 3, and I asked him if he had any tunes that he'd be up for me signing and potentially doing the remix of, and he sent me All I Need, which I really liked. I did the remix of it that I also was quite fond of, and we put that out as like the first main label release, and it did really well. It did all right, actually. And I was like, okay, so I don't have to have this pressure on me to just always be doing Meet in the Minds on the label. It could be regular releases as well. And then at the same time, I was speaking with Equinox about potentially doing a joint release, because Nebula, who releases a lot of music on Scientific Wax, had sent me a tune that I really liked, and I was thinking that maybe it'd be good to sort of connect with Marlon, Equinox, and sort of team join forces on the release to sort of like get this tune out, and something from him that I'd really liked. A tune called Bad Dreams that came out that he made in 94 that never saw the light of day. And then there was a Kid Lib tune that he'd done years and years and years ago called Only One. And funny enough, I don't think he wanted to release, because I think he's actually sampled an Amen from an Equinox tune. So I sort of felt like he felt a bit of guilt trying to put it out, because it was now coming out on this joint release with me, and Marlon sort of justified it. And then I had a tune on that as well, Drum Studies, and that dropped. And then after that, I was just like, all right, cool. So I can just play around with whatever I want to release on the label. And then I just sort of like, and also with the main label releases, it's sort of, it's a lot quicker and easier to put them together, because it sort of allows you to not have to directly work with someone to make a tune for the release. If they've already done a tune, they can just sign it and then just theme a release around that. So it's allowed me to pick up the pace a bit on the label, and sort of just to also have a bit of a breather from just collaborations. But yeah, the label has been going ridiculously well. I'm really grateful for all the support that I'm getting from all the fans, from those of DJs as well that like to play the music, like yourself, Jay. And this year, I'm not sure if people know, because I've mentioned it in the previous interview, but this year I've got two releases every month for the whole year on Future Retro London.
Nice, keeping busy, mate. And all this from an insightful dream. I mean, how amazing is that?
I know, honestly, like this is like the kind of thing where it's like, ah, oh, it's just a weird Beijing, who matters? But like with me, it's like, I don't know, it just really left an imprint on me as like, I've got to do something about this, because if I don't, I might regret having never tried out this idea. And I think it's done all right, actually, because like I've been able to sort of, like you say, use it as a platform to sort of bring through people that other people may not have been aware of until they saw that I released their music, or like just getting people on the same release where they wouldn't have in other circumstances. And just being able to sort of like connect the dots that people otherwise wouldn't have connected. So I sort of feel like it's been good for that, because like I do very much buy into this like strength in numbers, collective power kind of way, which I try and represent through the label. Because I think so far, if I factor in all the forthcoming releases as well, I think there's about 70 artists on the label. And I find that with a lot of other labels, they sort of revolve around a much smaller subset of like artists. Maybe it's just like you, or it's like you and your mates that you know. With me, it's like I want Future Retro London to be like sort of a snapshot of everyone that was doing stuff at this time, where it's like you can sort of say it was like that was Suburban Bass or Moonshadow. As much as they had their clicks, like there were so many people on there, it was very representative of the time. I sort of felt like Future Retro London could be an equivalent version of that in a way.
Well, I think you're certainly achieving that, mate, for sure. Now, listen, I'm conscious of time, because I know you need to leg it off and get a train.
Oh, yes, I do.
I would love to talk about, you know, can you give us an insight into who the artist that you've got coming up? Or, you know, are there any people that you really, that you haven't nailed down yet, that you really want to get on board for a collaboration?
Oh, well, I can't say that just yet, because then they might be like, it might be a bit out of blue. But I'll tell you some of the artists I've got more music coming from. So I've got more music coming from Ricky Force, because he just randomly one day just sent me like 18 tunes. And I was like, oh my goodness. And I tried to narrow it down to 4 and I just couldn't. So that one's actually going to be an 8-tracker release from Ricky Force. That one will be coming out in the summer. I've got a Split 12 coming from an artist called Eusebia, who I did a collab with on Meeting the Minds Volume 7. And that split with Eusebia and an anonymous artist called The Drizzle, who's previously released on the label, but he's asked to be made anonymous on this track, I think for sample reasons. I've got more music coming from Coco Bryce, Cloak, FFF. Got some more music coming from Nebula. I've got an EP coming out from DJ Sofa. I've got music coming from DJ Harmony. Well, just Harmony. I know he's, it's called Harmony now. I've got music coming from L Major as well. I've got more stuff coming from Sully. I've got an EP that Kid Lib has done under his Dub and Wheel alias. I've got a collaborative EP that I did with Mantra and Decibella. I've got, what else I've got? Meeting the Minds volume 11 and 12. I'm getting tunes done for those. I've got music coming from Pete Devnall as well. He's got an EP coming from my label. There's these two American producers that I met when I played in San Francisco called Solox and Serenado. They've done the release. I've got more music coming from Comfort Zone, really talented producer from Canada. And DJ Crumbs, I've done two tunes with him that are going to be coming out on a split 12, this guy from Bristol called Artificial Red. I've got music coming from Worldwide Epidemic. He's done a really, really good tune under his Liquid Silk alias that I'm going to be putting out. And I've got more music. I think I mentioned I've got music coming from FFF, but if not, I've got music coming from him as well. More music coming from Phineas too. And there's more stuff as well that isn't fully confirmed yet, so I'll hold off on that. But that stuff is all pretty much like lined up for this year.
It sounds like you're ready for a best of compilation already, mate.
Oh dear.
Nice, mate. Well, listen, I know you push for time, so we'll wrap it there. I could talk to you all day, mate. Listen, thank you very much for the time. I really appreciate you spending it today. Yeah. I'm going to wish you the best of luck for Future Retro and yourself, but I know you don't need it, but you're going to get it anyway.
Thank you, Jay.
It sounds like it's going to be an amazing year, and artists from all over the world as well, which is another really lovely thing to, you know, start hearing scenes. I've known of Worldwide Epidemic for a while and a couple of the US guys, so it's, you know, obviously people based in Germany, where have you, so, you know, it's nice to see it expanding to like a global thing, and you at the centre of that, pushing it, mate. So all the best, mate. Thank you very much for your time, mate, and we'll catch you soon.
All right, brilliant. Big up, Jay. Thank you so much.